I am Lydia Hutchinson. I'm the editor and publisher of Performing Songwriter magazine, and we have just finished our 100th issue. We're celebrating that.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Great. So you were born in the early 60s. Can you remember when you were first sort of conscious of the earliest Simon and Garfunkel material? Because you must have gotten it a little bit later, obviously, than when it was first released.
I was born in the early 60s, but my brother was born in the early 50s. So by the time I was, you know, 8 or 10, my brother Joe had all these albums, and we were playing the songs in our house a lot. And I remember, I have a vivid memory of one time being over at some family friend's house, and my brother and I were in front of a TV, and there was a special on with Simon and Garfunkel, and that had to have been early 70s, I would say. I couldn't have been much more than 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, even at that young age, how the music, I was moved by their music at the time, you know.
And do you know, let's do it in two phases then. Mm-hmm. Do you know what it was when you were that young that seemed to be compelling about the music?
The melody at that time, and I've always been drawn to melodies apparently from an early age now that I'm bringing it up. So I remember that, but I also remember the singability of the songs, even as a 10 or 12-year-old. The lyrics were easy to recall, and I could sing to them, and that's the gift of a great songwriter there.
Which ones probably were you singing when you were 10 or 11? Do you remember?
I remember singing "The Boxer." I remember singing. I certainly remember "Bridge Over Troubled Water." It was far more grandiose in my head at the time, I think. With the orchestration, but certainly "The Boxer," "America," those, you know, just the very acoustic and fun ones to harmonize with, the Scarborough Fair harmony. I enjoyed just singing along to those.
Yeah, and then I'm guessing that there may have been some time, and tell me if this is true or not, when you are getting into your teenage years where you break through to a certain different level of understanding of Paul Simon's earlier songs. Is that true?
I think when I first became aware of the depth of Paul Simon's writing was basically a chance to study his lyrics. Of just anything lyrical with him, it's almost a it's a classroom study. It's a you could take a whole course in it. And I think what he was doing at that time that became more obvious as I got older, and I think as listeners get older, is that he was always speaking for his generation. He always wrote for his generation, and he wrote honestly. And I think in the 50s, or people actually, a lot of people in the 60s were writing about things in the 50s still, instead of going on and addressing things that were in the 60s. Of course, they were still writing about more, you know, beboppy, "I Was in Love," or "Walking My Baby Home," or anything like that, when Dylan finally, I think, kicked in and brought it to a different level. And that was, of course, who Paul Simon was, you know, he was soaking up that kind of lyric writing, I think, from Dylan in that Greenwich Village scene at the time. So he brought it, you know, where Dylan had this certain level, and I think Paul Simon at that time was, I had read a story where he had actually gotten to go over to Dylan's house one day for the first time, and he was so excited about it. He said the house was, you know, there was just paper everywhere, and he was just walking along behind Dylan, who was kind of pacing in circles and was picking up sheets of paper and just putting them in his pocket, looking for any kind of, you know, ideas to how he wrote, how the lyrics were formed, you know, and I think a lot of people at that time were just being introduced to this whole new way of writing that Dylan brought. And Simon, I think, was one of the first real students of that, kind of, you know, from the outside looking in. But he certainly brought that kind of depth to his lyrics that there wasn't from the Brill Building days of right before that, you know.
Well, when you think about, you know, some of those early albums, what are some, you know, examples of this depth of writing that stand out for you? Are there songs that you can recall that kind of jump to the front of your mind?
Well, some of the earliest ones I would say are songs like The Boxer, the way he uses imagery, the way he sets up a story, the way he, I think, works so hard on that first sentence. For any writer, journalistically or in songwriting, I think it's that first sentence that's so important and it's so hard. And he actually pulls it off on just about all of his songs, I think. So that style, I mean, you're looking at, you know, I'm just a poor boy, though my story's seldom told. You know, that's already your setup for the whole, you're being brought in as a listener to set the stage for what's going on. And he took that, I think that's, he took that love of imagery through really, I mean, you can pretty much think of any song that he's written, you know, and they're all running through my head right now, but they all are just, they're filled with images. They're so tight. There's no wasted words. And I think it kind of, it really grew, it completely matured with Hearts and Bones, which was probably my favorite CD. And I think that was around 1983. And it was one of the most underappreciated, both by, I think, you know, commercially and by him, actually. But golly, those songs on there are, they're so vivid and so filled with imagery. And Renee and Georgette Magritte, for example, I mean, that song, you could study those lyrics and the rhythm of them. And Hearts and Bones is brilliant on that, you know.
I don't have the article in front of me, although I do have that magazine, but was it David who wrote did the most recent profile?
Bill Demain.
Bill Demain, okay.
Bill Demain did the interview. It was in the September issue of 06.
Right. I think he, in the introduction to his interview, posted the early 80s as something of a shift in the way Paul Simon wrote, talking a little bit about what was he saying, the sort of the either or, the ambiguity, the questioning attitude or something. As someone who's sort of followed his career, did you sort of sense something turning with that Hearts and Bones album or with the early 80s material that seemed like a shift for him somehow?
I think Paul Simon, during the 80s, like during the 70s and probably during the 60s, he was just growing through all of that. And of course, during the 60s, he was writing, I think, for two voices a lot. You know, that was so much a part of it, was the whole Simon and Garfunkel thing. And then to go out on his own in the 70s. And by the time he hit his 80s, he was at a different period in his life. And again, what he wrote about was for his age group. He's always written for adults. He writes about, you know, our questions and our dreams and all of our scars. And I think in the 80s, it was a point in his life where that was, you know, I think one of his marriages has ended. He was married to Carrie Fisher at the time. And Hearts and Bones is, kind of about the two of them. So I think at a certain point in our lives, at a certain age, we question more than we did before. You know, we're looking at things differently, and I think he has just always. There was a quote I remember of his where he said, "Music is forever, Music should grow and mature with you, following you right up until you die. And so I think from that, his music has always changed to fit, you know, whatever his age or whatever he's going through, and thus whatever the generation is going through, you know, that's right along with him.
Getting back to some of the earlier material and some of the themes, most writers talk about Paul Simon zeroing in on something of a disenchantment or an isolation. There's another word that I'm searching for that I don't quite have, but alienation, that that he was particularly skilled at weaving into his writing at that time. Could you talk a little bit about that, or whether or not it ever came through to you as a teen listener when you started revisiting that material?
Probably what he was writing about during that time in the 70s didn't resonate with me until probably sometime in the 80s or 90s, to be quite honest, you know, and it was me catching up with what he was writing about, and you know, a lot of the turmoil of the time, the post-Vietnam time, you know, that was such a dark and rich time for so many of our songwriters. It shifted so much of the writing topics and styles. So I think probably it was later in my life that I fully appreciated Paul Simon's writing, and I still am learning to appreciate it. I still will go back and just read lyrics or listen to old albums of his, and it brings a depth of appreciation that I surely didn't have before, because now I am, you know, I might be the age that he was when he wrote it, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Right. Do you on the kind of earlier Simon and Garfunkel albums, even before Bridge Over Troubled Water, is there a tune or two there that you kind of can say that you like? What I was thinking of doing, I've got the lyric book here, and I was going to maybe read a little bit of it and just get your impressions on it after you've, again, heard the lyrics again.
I'm trying to think of what was on certain albums.
Well, let's see.
America?
America was actually on Bookends. So, yeah, America is the one which tells the story, you know, of him and a girlfriend. It's like this conversation, let us be lovers, we'll marry our fortunes together, I've got some real estate here in my bag. So we bought a pack of cigarettes and Mrs. Wagner pies and walked off to look for America. And it's him and Kathy on the bus, you know, mm-hmm. Toss me a cigarette, I think there's one in my raincoat. And then the last verse goes, Kathy, I'm lost, I said, though I know she was sleeping. I'm empty and aching and I don't know why. Counting the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike, they've all come to look for America. All come to look for America. All come to look for America.
You know, even just hearing you read that, it chokes me up. Like, those are brilliant lyrics, and they captured a moment. And they captured a moment not only in time, but in a point of a person's life when you're searching. You've hit a certain age. All the details are there. Every little detail. You can hear things going on the highway, you know, when it's in your head. You know, the person next to him is dozing off, but all these questions are in his head. And then he realizes that we're all searching. We're all at this point in our lives where we're all looking, and we want something so simple, you know. It's a brilliant song.
And if you're willing, I think this might help, because if you would want me to try this for another song or two, because I think, you know, in the construction, as you've heard in a program like this, it's like, it's nice to be able to hear the song and then hear somebody like what you just said give us a chance to reflect back on it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll read a couple of other song titles and you can stop me. Like, there's Homeward Bound.
Oh, love Homeward Bound.
Yeah. So this one is, again, kind of like I'm interested in what the point you made about your first the first lines. I'm sitting at a railway station, got a ticket for my destination. On a tour of one-night stands, my suitcase and guitar in hand, and every stop is neatly planned for a poet and a one-man band. Homeward bound, I wish I was homeward bound. Home, where my thoughts escaping. Home, where my music's playing. Home, where my love lies waiting silently for me. Tonight I'll sing my songs again. I'll play the game and pretend. But all my words come back to me in shades of mediocrity, like emptiness and harmony. I need someone to comfort me, homeward bound. And then, again, the refrain as well.
I think homeward bound, the lyrics to that were perfectly captured the essence of what it's like to live the life of a traveling musician. There's the loneliness, the theme that runs through so many songwriters' songs is home. They don't even know what home is half the time because they're never there, but they have such a picture or a dream of what it would be like, where somebody's waiting for you, where you're safe, you know. But what they live is this series of one-night stands where, you know, they've got their guitar and they go and it's set up for them and it's perfect for a one-man band. And then they go to the next place and there's that moment where they stop and they're waiting. They're waiting for the bus and they're thinking about what it would be like to have a home, to be home, you know. And that's, again, it's there's not a wasted lyric. He set it up so you can picture the guy sitting there with his guitar waiting and just daydreaming.
There's also something interesting about this in the sort of legendary insecurity that artists have. All my words come back to me in shades of mediocrity, emptiness, and harmony. It's like no matter how great some of these people are, there's always that sort of haunting of uncertainty about whether they're getting it done.
Absolutely. Artists absolutely are. They're part of what makes them an artist is that insecurity. Because, I mean, the thought of creating something and being that vulnerable and that open and then putting it out to be judged, you know, the other side of it has got to be some kind of insecurity. And yeah, as great as the greatest, you know, as great as he is at writing, that was a very honest statement that, again, it let you know exactly what it's like to live that life. And to doubt yourself, and quite honestly, it can be applied to anything. Maybe it's a part of one's age. You know enough to know that you don't know everything, you know, or that you might not have nailed it like you thought.
I know that you're something of a fan of the song that somehow defines a moment in a relationship, and I'm looking at this one that was on Bookends called "Overs," which when I start reading the lyrics, you'll probably hear the tune in your head. But why don't we stop fooling ourselves? The game is over, over, over. No good times, no bad times. There's no times at all, just the New York Times, sitting on the windowsill near the flowers. We might as well be apart. It hardly matters. We sleep separately and drop a smile passing in the hall. I'm jumping down a little bit. Time is tapping on my forehead, hanging from my mirror, rattling the teacups. And I wonder, how long can I delay? We're just a habit like saccharin. I'm habitually feeling kind of blue, but each time I try on the thought of leaving you, I stop. I stop and think it over.
Yeah, that song is one of my favorite two overs is, and it's, again, it captures a moment. It captures a moment and a thought of somebody who's not in, you know, in the beginning of a first love. It's a mature love, and with that comes a lot of, you know, you don't want to leave it, you don't want to lose it, but yeah, look at what it's turned into. And for somebody to, I remember it is the simplest of songs. It's a simple acoustic melody that because it's so honest and It captures the minutia of a moment, and a thought, that it makes it that much more powerful. And again, it's a grown-up song.
Have you or any of your other writers written or thought or tried to articulate what's special about his guitar figures or the way guitar... Because, and here's the reason I'm asking this question, is I'm taking my second group guitar lesson, and the teacher, you know, is telling me, you know, every time a class comes in, you know, they want to know Dylan songs, Beatles songs, and Paul Simon songs. And part of the reason being that there's, you know, just something elegant about and inventive about the way he plays guitar or works guitar figures into these. Is there something that can be said about that?
I don't think I can add to that. I know what you're talking about, but I don't think I could add anything to that Simon's guitar playing is, it sounds so simple, and it's so not simple. You know, it's not a, I've actually tried to, you know, play it. So it's not a simple thing. It's, I do know that he marries his melodies to the lyrics so beautifully in a not trite way. You know, it's sometimes it's unexpected. But that's, you know, that's what I could say about his guitar playing, honestly.
And these are sort of different ways to ask the questions, but in some ways you may have answered them already. But, I mean, do you have young people in your life, nieces or nephews or teens that you cross paths with?
I do.
Okay.
Yes,
so if you, you know, we're going to sit them down in the age of rap and hip hop, and do you think there's a way that you could direct them to an appreciation of Paul Simon? What might you try out on them to say if they said, "Oh, what's so great about Paul Simon?"
I think today's youth could be I think best introduced to him by more of the world music side of him, the, you know, the introduction that he brought to us of the different styles of music that I think have found their way into not only pop music but into hip hop. But I think that there's a certain segment of youth who are really interested in lyrical quality, you know, in the rhythm of words, and certainly the more artistic, the more youth who are more driven to poetry, and I think at that point it's a good time to bring Paul Simon into their lives. He's always been accomplished as a pop writer, when pop radio was really a different breed than what it is now, I should add. But you know, he always found his way. His music always found his way into another generation. I think the question isn't so much about could Paul Simon's music find his way into the upcoming generation. It's what is this next generation going to be listening to, and how are they listening? Because it's how they hear music and how they find music. Is so different. Music is disposable to this generation, which is a whole other conversation.
Yeah. Well, and I'm wondering if, you know, a lot of people talk about Paul Simon, exploratory chip, you know, where he's looking for new sounds. And his latest record, when I listened to it, it does sound contemporary in a way. I mean, I can imagine there are certain tunes in there and certain soundscapes that Brian Eno came up with that would be pretty appealing to young people.
Possibly. It's hard for me to know exactly. I can talk about specific youth, but as a whole, I know that it's a generational thing right now that's still working itself out of how they're even exposed to music. How would they hear him? How does anybody break through? And what I do think, if it's someone who is interested in studying music and studying lyric writing and studying the rhythm of words in classes, he would be one of the first artists I would bring up to teach writing, a writing class on.
You know, this thing that you said about first lines is really hitting home with me as I'm looking over lyrics. And a song that came out, it was the second solo album, the hit Kodachrome,
mm-hmm.
starts off with this: "When I think back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all."
Yep. Every you could look at just about any of his songs, and that first sentence is going to set up the song. He worked so hard on that. Everything from "I met my old lover on the street last night" from Still Crazy to "The problem is all inside your head," she said to me, from 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover. "Let us be lovers, we'll marry our fortunes together." We talked about that in America. "Homeward Bound," you know, sitting in a railway station. They're all a setup. They put the listener right there, and even set up if it's going to be a funny song. "You Can Call Me Al." That what does it start with? "Why is my life soft in the middle when the rest of my life is so hard?" You know, it's that first line sets it up for the kind of song it's going to be, and then the next verse, he'll throw another one in there.
Well, like you said, it's an invitation to empathize or identify. Like, you know, when I just read that line about high school, it's like, you know, everybody can say, "This song's for me," right away.
Yep. Yeah, he does. He does. He sets it up so you do. You enter it. You become a part of it, and everything about it you can grab onto somehow in your life because you're out of high school, because you lived through high school, you know, like for that particular song. And again, because he writes for adults. He writes for who we've become. And he writes it honestly, and that's a real I think just a real trademark of his writing.
Well, are there any other things that you were thinking about before in your 2 hours of cramming for this?
I've noticed that a lot of the songs that Paul Simon has written, which became hits, have somehow crossed over and become part of pop culture, or they've become part of idioms that we all use. Everything from "Bridge Over Troubled Water," we use that now just as part of sentences, or "Still Crazy After All These Years," or "Slip Sliding Away," or 50 Ways to Leave Whatever. Those were all his, they were all his lyrics, they were all his titles, and I think it's fascinating. I don't know other songwriters who have written songs that have actually just become part of our American idiom book, you know.
Well, you can probably count them on one hand anyway.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.